We have been studying the miracles of Jesus, the works of Jesus, and have taken a break for a while. Actually, we got to the point where Jesus called his first disciples full time and found that to be so significant, the idea of God's calling, that we're focusing on this for a while and taking a break from studying the miracles to look at what the Bible says about God's calling. How do you know your calling? We studied that first, found out how you can discover what the general area of your calling is, what is your role in the ministry of the church, and we did that study. And then from there, you know, it's important to know your general role in life. But there's also the question, how do I know step by step, day by day, hour by hour, what I should do? How do I make decisions in life? How do I know what God's will is for me to do the very next decision that's coming up in my life? How do I know what path to take through life? And we found the incredible promise that God will carry you through life, that He guides you and will see to it that you end up exactly where He wants you to be. Now, the path that you take to get there can be a tough one or an easier one, depending on whether or not you utilize wisdom. And we found that that is the way that God guides us through life. He doesn't guide us through life by telling us the future. He doesn't guide us through life by revealing to us what His will is for the future. People are always asking, you know, how do I know God's will for the future? James 4 teaches, remember, that we're not to know God's will for the future. He doesn't guide us that way. The way He guides us is by revealing us, teaching us wisdom. And through wisdom, we become skilled at decision-making, and then we do that, and God takes care of His part, which is He arranges orchestrates all the circumstances in life that are outside of your control to see to it that you end up exactly where He wants you to be. That's the promise for the Christian. So we've been studying wisdom, and of course, the primary place in Scripture to study wisdom is the wisdom literature, which centers around the book of Proverbs. So we've been delving into Proverbs. The last couple times, it's just kind of introduced Proverbs and talked about how to interpret a proverb. And now, finally, we're going to actually begin studying the book. It's not going to be a verse-by-verse study, so don't worry about that. We'll do that sometime in the future, maybe. But we're just going to take a few weeks and cover the major themes of the book of Proverbs. Now, think about this. How do you make a wise decision? You face a tough decision in life. How do you make sure you make the right decision? What do you do? Some people have suggested, well, you know, you get a whiteboard or piece of paper or something, and you write down all the pros and all the cons, and then just sort of compare. Which might be helpful in certain important decisions, but there's a couple of problems with that approach. First of all, it's not very practical for the majority of decisions in life. You can't sit around all day long in the thousands of decisions you make every day writing out lists of pros and cons. Besides that, the issue really isn't how many pros and cons there are anyway. You might have a decision that has 500 pros and only one con, but the con is so important it outweighs all the pros, right? I mean, maybe you're facing a decision to take a job somewhere, and it's going to be a great job, and it's going to be a lot of money, and it's going to be in your field, and you're going to advance, and it's going to be in a place you love to live and near your friends and everything else. A lot of pros, but there's one con. You know, it's a place where your child has allergies, and if you move there, your child will be bedridden all the time, sick, maybe even life-threatening for him. Well, that's an easy decision, isn't it? You don't have to agonize over that decision. You don't have to come up with a list of pros and cons. You just immediately know that you're not going to go there. And the reason is because, you know, your child's life is far more important than anything else that could be on the other side, the positive side. So, the way we make decisions isn't so much on lists of pros and cons as it is with priorities. You set your priorities. The way to take the right path through life, remember we talked about Yashar, the Yashar path through life, the ideal path through life. The way to find the ideal path through life is by setting your priorities such that almost all decisions are easy. When you have your priorities set, then your mind will actually make decisions automatically based on your priorities. Maybe we can turn this mic down even a little more. Pretty soon you won't hear me at all. It's ringing a little bit there. There are plenty, and if you go through Proverbs, you find there's a lot of specific Proverbs that are very specific. They apply to a very direct circumstance It's real specific. And those are real helpful, obviously, but we couldn't have all Proverbs be that way. If God wrote a proverb for every conceivable situation in life, a specific proverb for that, well, your life would be over by the time you got done reading through there. You would never be able to find it. It'd be too big. So what we have instead are general principles that teach us which things in life are more important than other things. The more you study the Proverbs, the more your priorities in your heart are adjusted so that you make decisions correctly and follow the wise path through life. And so you find yourself taking the ideal path through life and making wise decisions without even consciously realizing how it is that you're making the decisions. You instinctively know what the best choices are without putting a lot of effort into the decision-making process. That's called intuition. I looked up intuition in the dictionary the other day to find out what it means, and here's what Webster says. Intuition is the immediate knowing of something without conscious reasoning. You immediately know it without consciously reasoning through it. You know, God has designed your brain in an amazing way. It has the ability, your brain, to actually, your mind makes the vast majority of decisions in life behind your back. Really, I mean, if you think about it, you don't consciously think about most decisions throughout the day. Your brain just makes them subconsciously and does it without you consciously having to reason through it. It's a good thing God made it that way, otherwise we'd go insane trying to make every decision, thinking it through. The way your mind does that is you put the priorities in there, and then your subconscious just analyzes which priorities are most important and makes decisions based on that as you go through life. Let me just illustrate what I'm talking about, because I don't know if I'm making myself clear here, but suppose you're driving, you park your car, you get out of the car, your little child runs out the other door and runs out in front of traffic. And you step away, and then all of a sudden you notice the car door is left open. And the wind is blowing papers out of there, important papers out of your car. Now you have to make a decision. Do I step back here and shut the door first and then go and rescue my child from the traffic? Or do I just immediately go out and try and save my child? And you can make up a whole list of pros and cons. And there might be a lot of pros to the first option, you know, because it's a more efficient use of time. Maybe you're closer to the car and you could save the papers first and then go take care of and a lot of stuff like that. But you don't go through any kind of long-term reasoning process like that. You just run out and try and save your child's life. And why? Because of your priorities. You have priorities set such that your child's life, there isn't a paper anywhere in the world that's worth risking your child's life, right? And so that's not a hard decision. You can make it instantly. Subconsciously, your mind just does it based on your priorities. Now, if you didn't value your child's life, then it might be a tough decision. But based on your priorities, it becomes easy. And the goal is to get your priorities set so that all decisions are like that. You know, the question, when you think about making wise decisions, it's not so much, should I do this or should I do that? I mean, should I take this job and make money, or should I buy this house, or should I take this opportunity for recreation? That's not really the question. You know, every one of those decisions is a give and take, right? In order to do something, you have to not do something else. Whatever you decide to do is going to cost you something. The question is, which is more important, the thing that you're going to get or the thing that you're going to have to give up? That's the way you make a decision. It's based on priorities. How much of that, you know, if I take this job and make this money, how much is that money worth in comparison with what I'm going to have to do in this job? If I'm going to have an opportunity for recreation, you know, what's that going to cost? And how important are those reasons? If I'm thinking about moving to this house, how important is that? You know, the benefits of moving there or whatever. And it's all set on priorities. In Mark chapter 6, you see Jesus making a decision to leave the crowds and take a break, take a day off to get some rest, because that was a priority. He realized that was very important, more important at that point than ministry. And then he gets in a boat and crosses over, and he gets in the same chapter, you see him make another decision to cancel his day off and get back into ministry because that was a higher priority. And so Jesus follows this pattern. He just goes through and he makes decisions based on the things that are most important. So, if you open your Bible to Proverbs chapter 1, the most important principle in the whole book of Proverbs is in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. And I need to explain something to you here that's very important in understanding this principle. Most of the Bible teaches us about spiritual things, spiritual issues, righteousness, holiness, Christ-likeness, and godliness. That's what most of the Bible teaches us. But then the wisdom literature is different, because the wisdom literature teaches you practical things about how to have a smooth path through life and how to make wise decisions. That's what the definition of wisdom is, skill in decision making. And so, it's a different kind of literature in the Bible. It's just basically practical tips on how to make decisions. Like, for instance, Proverbs 18:16 says, a gift opens the way for the giver and ushers him into the presence of the great. Now, that's not a spiritual issue. That's not dealing with righteousness or sin in any way. It's just an observation of the way life generally happens, and a wise person will understand that and make shrewd use of gifts. In fact, one of the most common mistakes people make in interpreting the Proverbs is they try and spiritualize everything. They try to make every proverb talk about a spiritual issue, and they get into a lot of confusion. Proverbs are not spiritual commands. They're just observations. We talked a couple weeks ago about things that tend to happen in life. And wisdom is the ability to take those observations and use them to make wise decisions. So you get to, say, Proverbs 26:4 that we talked about before. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him yourself. And then the very next verse says, answer a fool according to his folly, otherwise he'll be wise in his own eyes. Now, that's not an issue of righteousness. It's not a sin to answer a fool according to his folly. It's not a sin to not answer a fool according to his folly. It's not talking about righteousness. It's just observations about things that tend to happen when you're dealing with fools. And a wise person will understand that and be able to make wise decisions when next time he's dealing with a fool. He'll understand the pros and cons of answering the guy. That's the way it works. So, Proverbs are designed not to teach you about how to be more godly, but how to make wise decisions in life. Now, on the other hand, there are Proverbs that do talk about righteousness and wickedness. Proverbs 15:29, the Lord is far from the wicked, but hears the prayer of the righteous. So now it seems like there's two different kinds of Proverbs. You've got the practical ones for making good decisions over here, that are just, you know, for practical, mundane issues of life. And then over here you've got the spiritual issues that deal with righteousness and holiness and wickedness and so on. Two categories. And, you know, if you're preaching a series on how to make wise decisions, then what you want to do is go through and just mark the ones that aren't talking about any spiritual thing. They're just talking about the real practical nuts and bolts of how to make a decision, a wise decision. Well, if you do that, you're not going to use up much ink out of your highlighter pen, because a huge number of the Proverbs talk about righteousness. Now, why is that? Why, in a book that's supposed to be giving us practical hints on how to get through life, do we get all these verses about righteousness? The whole rest of the Bible talks about righteousness and holiness. Why so many verses in Proverbs? The answer to that question is right in the very first proverb. You know, I mean, the very first six verses of the book of Proverbs tell you what the Proverbs are for and what they do. And then Proverbs 1:7, this very important verse. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Righteousness is the starting place of wise decision making. You see, you got the spiritual things that have to do with righteousness and holiness and the fear of God and etc. on the one hand, and then you got the practical tips on how to make decisions on the other hand. And what Solomon is saying is, the most practical tip on how to take a smooth path through life is righteousness. The fear of the Lord. That's the beginning of being wise. That's the point he's making. And that's really a profound thought. There are, you know, it's not that there's two kinds of Proverbs, the spiritual ones and the practical ones. There's only one kind, the practical ones. That's the only kind there is. And the whole book, from beginning to end, is just the practical ones. Those Proverbs that are about righteousness and holiness are practical. See if I can explain what I mean. If you want to have a smooth life and you want things to go well for you, or say your kids, you're trying to teach your kids how to just make wise decisions and smart decisions in life, And you teach them things like how to handle money well, how to deal with their emotions, how to handle relationships, how to deal with different kinds of people, how to be diligent, all that kind of stuff. Practical tips in life. But most of all, if you want their life to go smooth, if you want their life, them to have the Yishar path through life, you teach them righteousness. The most practical thing, advice you can give them, is to be godly. Because righteousness and godliness has countless fringe benefits through life. Generally speaking, your life will go better when you're righteous than if you're unrighteous. Now, I hope you understand what I'm saying here. There are other reasons to be righteous that are far more important than this. I mean, the rest of the Scripture says we should... I mean, there's dozens of reasons why we should be righteous. You should be righteous because you're a child of God. You should be righteous because it's your nature as a Christian to be righteous. You should be righteous because of, the consequences of sin and the spiritual aspect. You should be righteous because that's God has commanded you to do that, and that's we're in a position of obedience. You should be righteous because you love God and He's righteous and you want to be like Him. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be righteous, a lot of spiritual reasons to be righteous. But Proverbs throws another one in. You know, you should just be righteous because it's the best path through life to take. You're going to be way better off if you're righteous. Your life will generally go smoother. Proverbs 22:5 says, "In the paths of the wicked lie thorns and snares, but he who guards his soul stays far from them." Now, that's just, you know, you go through life and you're wicked, you're going to have a lot of thorns, a lot of snares that you're going to run into, and if you're righteous, you won't run into near as many. Like every proverb, like every proverbial principle, there's exceptions to that. That's not an absolute statement. Obviously, there are troubles that you will run into as a righteous person. Of course, in fact, we see that with Job. Job ran into troubles and problems in life, not only did he run into them, but the very reason he had those troubles in life was because of his righteousness, right? So sometimes being righteous can cause more trouble in life. Or Paul, you know, all these problems Paul had, they were because of his godliness and because of his righteousness. So it's not an absolute statement, but the principle is still valid. In general, life will go smoother if you're righteous. There are trials and problems and disasters and everything that will come into every person's life. Listen, as long as you're on earth, then you're not in heaven. And if you're here in this cursed earth, you're going to have trouble, no matter who you are. But Proverbs 13:21 says, "Misfortune pursues the sinner." If you're unrighteous, you increase the number of those troubles. Proverbs 13:15 says, "The way of the unfaithful is hard." Now I realize this is basic stuff for you folks, real basic. But you know, I don't choose what I preach on. I just if we're doing a series on Proverbs and there's all these proverbs about righteousness, then I'm going to preach on righteousness. And so this is a great reminder for us. Misfortune pursues the sinner, and the way of the unfaithful is hard. And the reason for that is in Proverbs 10:29. Turn to Proverbs 10:29. I'll show you a profound proverb. Proverbs 10:29. "The way of the Lord is a refuge for the righteous, but it is the ruin of those who do evil." The way of the Lord is a refuge for the righteous, but the way of the Lord, the second part of that is what's fascinating, the way of the Lord is ruin for those who do evil. You see, a righteous life fits the system that God has created. An unrighteous life clashes with it. You commit immorality and you destroy your family. You commit the sin of selfishness and you lose your friends. You steal something and then you lie to cover it up, and then you tell other lies to cover those up, and you hide everything, and then you try to keep track of all those lies, and it results in a great amount of stress and difficulty in life. In fact, Proverbs 28:1 says, "The wicked man flees, though no one pursues. The righteous are as bold as a lion." The wicked man's running away, nobody's even after him. He's got a guilty conscience. The wicked are always uneasy and fearful, even when no one's after them, because they're scared and they're running. And the reason they're running is they're running from exposure and shame and disgrace. But they won't succeed. Disgrace will overtake them. Proverbs 18:3 says, "When the wickedness comes, so does contempt. And with shame comes disgrace." They won't escape it. You know, you can keep a sin in the secret for a while, But it'll come out. Numbers 32:23, you remember, be sure your sin will find you out. It will. In fact, Proverbs 10:9 says, he who takes crooked paths will be found out. I heard, you know how Paul Harvey does those stories of dumb criminals that do stupid things? I heard one of those recently. He said this guy went into a store and stole an alarm clock. And I just put it under his coat, and he's trying to get out of the store. And before he made it out of the store, the alarm went off, and he got caught. So, you know, sometimes it's right away like that. It's not always immediate, but one way or the other, you take a crooked path through life, and you'll be found out. But it says the righteous is bold as a lion. Just righteous person is relaxed and comfortable because there's no guilt. There's nothing to hide. There's no danger of exposure. You're driving down the highway, and you see a policeman. You don't have to slam on your brake. If you're going the speed limit, right? You just wait. He who takes a crooked path will be found out, but the man of integrity walks securely. Proverbs 29:6 says, an evil man is snared by his own sin, but a righteous one can sing and be glad. The wicked can't do that. You know, a guy robs a bank, and he's sitting in his living room, and every single knock at the door scares him to death. I mean, the doorbell rings and he might be running, even though no one's pursuing. You know, he might run out the back door, scared to death, and all it is, you know, the pizza he ordered or something. Someone's selling Girl Scout cookies or whatever. So, that's one of the benefits of righteousness. Another practical benefit of righteousness, people are going to be nicer to you. And just in general, people are going to like you more. Again, there's obvious exceptions to that, but generally speaking, Proverbs 16:7 says, when a man's ways are pleasing to Yahweh, he makes even his enemies live at peace with him. You're going to have a lot more peace in your relationships. Proverbs 29:2, when the righteous thrive, the people rejoice. People are going to be happy when things go well for you. Proverbs 22:11, if you love a pure heart and your speech is gracious, then you will have a king for a friend. You say, is that an absolute promise? Well, of course not. Proverbs 29:10 says, bloodthirsty men hate a man of integrity and seek to kill the upright. Some people aren't going to like you at all. But generally speaking, if you want to give your kids good advice, you want them to have a life that's a lot smoother, you want to help them out financially and socially, and you want them to have a better friendships and a better job and a good family situation, better living conditions, you want that for your kids, you teach them to be righteous. All these things will be true of them. And there's a whole list of others. I'm not going to go through them all. Proverbs 10:28 says the righteous are more likely to have joy in life. Proverbs 10:3 says the righteous are more likely to have provisions. Proverbs 13:9 says the righteous are more likely to be in a position of prominence and to gain wealth. And just on and on and on the list goes. So if you're at a wedding and you need to give a toast the bride and groom, and you want to give them the most practical thing that will really help them the most in their marriage, tell them to obey God and to be Christ-like. Proverbs 16:17 says, he who guards his way guards his life. That means he who doesn't guard his way risks his life. You know, unrighteousness will have consequences not only on Judgment Day, but it'll foul up your life right now. Making a decision to resist a temptation is a high priority. It's like saving your life. I mean, it's like you're driving on an icy mountain highway with a lot of curves and dangerous corners and everything. And when you see a temptation coming up on the horizon, that's like coming up at high speed on an icy road on a hairpin curve in the mountains. It's dangerous. You better sit up and grip the wheel and take it very seriously, because your life's at stake, is what this proverb is saying. So, you should be righteous because that's the better path through life. Again, pretty basic principle. But what is righteousness? And we know we're supposed to be righteous. What is it? We see the word over 100 times in the book of Proverbs. Almost as many times as the word wise. So it's pretty important. What is it? What does it mean to be righteous? Well, one thing it doesn't mean, I'll tell you this right now, it doesn't mean religion. Proverbs 21:3 makes that clear. Proverbs 21:3, to do what is right and just is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. So here you got righteousness being contrasted with ritual. Righteousness is not the same thing as religious ritual. It's not religious activity. So you say, well, if righteousness isn't religious activity, what is it? Well, look at the first part of Proverbs 21:3. To do what is right and just. That's it. Pretty simple. Righteousness is doing what's right. You say, but wait a minute. Everybody does what's right some of the time. And nobody does what's right all the time. So we're all in the same boat, right? But Proverbs divides it up into two specific, clear-cut categories. The righteous and the wicked. Now, who's the righteous and who's the wicked? If we all do some wicked things and we all do some righteous things, who are the righteous and who are the wicked? Well, that distinction is a distinction that the readers of Proverbs would have known very well, because it's a distinction that's made way back in Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15 verse 6, which is the most important verse in the whole Bible on salvation, I believe. Most important verse in the whole Bible on salvation. Genesis 15:6. It says, Abraham trusted in Yahweh and it was credited to him as righteousness. And if you want to comment, you want to buy a commentary on that verse, read the book of Romans. The whole book of Romans is a commentary on that one verse. Abraham trusted in Yahweh and it was credited to him as righteousness. You see, the people who believe the words of God and entrust their lives to Him, those people, God considers them righteous, even though they do unrighteous things. That's what salvation by faith means. So, the righteous, when you get into Proverbs and you read about the righteous, the righteous are the believers. The people who believe, who have faith, who believe the words of God and have entrusted their lives to Him. The wicked are the unbelievers. Say, how can I tell which one I am? Well, you can tell by turning to Proverbs 15:9. You don't know if you're in the category of the wicked or the category of the righteous? You know, a lot of people claim to believe and don't. There's such a thing as a phony believer. So how do you know if it's genuine? How do you know if you're really saved? Well, Proverbs 15:9. The Lord detests the way of the wicked, but He loves those who pursue righteousness. Now, that's a fascinating proverb. He doesn't say in this proverb, He loves those who carry out righteousness, who achieve righteousness, those who pursue righteousness. Romans 2 says the same thing. You can tell if you're a genuine believer by what you pursue in life. It has to do with your desires. The issue in examining the genuineness of your faith is not perfection, it's direction. What direction are you moving in? What's the desire of your heart? What kind of desires do you have? Proverbs 14:22 says, those who plot evil go astray, but those who plan what is good find love and faithfulness. The difference between the wicked and the righteous is one of them plots bad things, the other one plans good things. What are the desires of your heart, the intentions of your heart? Which way is your life moving? We both sin. The righteous people sin, the wicked people sin. The difference is the righteous people hate their sin. The wicked people love it. The righteous people, if they had their way, they'd be rid of it. The wicked people, secretly deep down, they don't want to give it up, ever. They want to keep hold on to it. That's the difference. Proverbs 13:2 says, the unfaithful crave violence. They just long for it. The righteous people long for righteousness. They wish they wouldn't sin. Well, how do you get more righteousness? How do you get it? Well, we're right back to the same thing we started with. Proverbs 16:6 says, through the fear of the Lord, a man avoids evil. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of it, of wisdom. And then it's through the fear of the Lord that you gain more righteousness. Fear of the Lord. Fear means respect, awe, and fear of His retribution and punishment. That's what the fear of the Lord is. And it's through that that you gain more righteousness. So, that's just kind of a summary of everything the book of Proverbs says about righteousness. You say, what does that have to do with wise decision making? How does that help me make practical, wise decisions in practical, everyday things in life, like going on a vacation or taking a job or moving or whatever, making a purchase? Well, if you want to take the very best path through life, then you need to make every decision with righteousness as your number one priority. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Remember what we said at the beginning about priorities? The way you make good decisions is you have your priorities set in your mind. You know, the more you study the book of Proverbs, the more subconsciously your priorities will adjust in your mind so that righteousness will become more and more and more important to you on the inside in your subconscious mind, in the part of your mind that makes decisions without you consciously thinking through things. And decisions will become much easier. Just like you instinctively, intuitively knew it was the best thing to just run out and try to save your child without messing around with the door. In the same way, all the decisions in life will become easier as righteousness becomes a higher priority. And as the more you study Proverbs and see the benefits of righteousness, the higher that priority level will rise in your mind. You know, Proverbs teaches us that money is important. In fact, we're going to have a whole sermon just on money. Because Proverbs has so much to say about that. Fascinating things that I've been learning about money in Proverbs. And money's important. It's very, very, very important. Jesus taught that it's important. But you know, Proverbs 28:6 says, "Better a poor man whose walk is blameless than a rich man's whose ways are perverse." Even though money will help you out a lot in life, you're better to not have any and be righteous than to have a lot and not be righteous, because righteous is the highest priority. It's more important than money. Now, you say, that's so obvious. Well, yeah, but you have to understand, this is not talking from a spiritual standpoint. From a spiritual standpoint, of course that's true. Of course it's better to be righteous than to be wicked. You know, it's just thinking in terms of spiritual things. But keep in mind, we're in Proverbs. This is not talking from a spiritual perspective. This is talking from a practical perspective in life. Even from a practical perspective in the mundane, ordinary, physical realm, you're better off to be blameless and not have any money than to be wicked and have a lot of money, because righteousness is more important. If you want to have comfort and joy and ease and things in life, you're going to have a smoother path through life if you're righteous. And righteousness will contribute more to that than money will. Proverbs 15:16, "Better is a little with the fear of Yahweh than great wealth with turmoil." And you can think of money in these Proverbs as a symbol of everything the world has to offer. Any physical, earthly thing is represented here by money. The fact is, righteousness is a higher priority than any earthly thing. And that's really the point of the book of Ecclesiastes. The whole book of Ecclesiastes teaches us that. I love that book. You know, over and over it says everything is futile under the sun, under the sun. If you don't take God into consideration, everything just on this earth in and of itself is meaningless, useless. And the only meaning comes in life is if you look beyond the sun to God. You know, if you want to sum up the whole book of Ecclesiastes, this is a great thing, a great way to do it. Pleasure is a byproduct of looking beyond the sun, but pain is a byproduct of living for the goal of pleasure. You understand that? Pleasure is a byproduct of looking beyond the sun, but pain is the byproduct of living for the goal of pleasure. Go through Ecclesiastes and find some of the maybe troublesome passages that are hard for you to understand, and apply that statement to those, and it'll open up your understanding. So what does this have to do with decision making? Listen, it's the most important factor in decision making. Having righteousness is your utmost priority. And there are many, many practical ways to use that in decision making. You're going to take a job in some place. Number one factor in your mind is spiritual considerations. How's this going to affect my family spiritually? Have you gone to that town and checked out the church situation? Is there a Bible teaching church there? I can't imagine God would call you to go to a place where there's not a Bible teaching church, unless He's calling you to go start one there. I mean, if you've got a family, you've got to consider the well-being of your family. A person that doesn't care about spiritual things or spiritual issues are a low priority. They'll look at every consideration about a job, and they won't even concern themselves with what the church situation is there. But if righteousness is a high priority, then that's going to be a major factor in your decision making. If you have a job and this job is gonna take you away from fellowship, it's gonna make it so that you can't spend time in fellowship with people. If spiritual things are a high priority, then that's gonna be a major factor in your decision making process. Taking your spiritual gift into consideration. This is a very important thing. Remember we talked about your general calling? You know generally what your calling is, what your giftedness is. You use that at the forefront of all your decision making. Every decision you make through life should revolve around accomplishing this task that God has given you to do, right? So suppose God has given you the gift of giving. Suppose that's your spiritual gift. You're a giver. And you have to make a decision about a job. And this job over here, has short hours and low pay. And this job over here has long hours and high pay. Well, if your gift is the gift of giving, you're probably going to want to take this job. You're going to work overtime, work however long, you can do whatever you can do to get as much money as you can get your hands on so that you can give and you can accomplish God's purpose in your life through that spiritual gift. And that's very important for you as a giver. But what if you have the spiritual gift, say, of teaching, involves a lot of time in study, or say a spiritual gift that involves a lot of time with people. Say that you want to have time open to go and visit folks in the hospital, and that's part of your ministry in the church. Well, then you're going to choose this job maybe over here that has you don't make very much money, and maybe you have to cut back on your standard of living and cut back here and there, but it gives you a lot of free time, a lot of flexibility, and you can carry out these other factors. You see, your calling, your spiritual giftedness is at the forefront of all decision making. And that's the high priority. You're trying to decide whether or not to go on some trip and you're going to be alone and you're just going to open you up to certain temptations. That's a major factor in making a decision. You're planning a vacation and you're trying to decide, should I go on a weekday where I'll miss work or should I go on a weekend where I'll miss church? Again, a significant factor. So, righteousness is the number one consideration. And the more you study the book of Proverbs, the more that will rise in your subconscious as a priority. And you'll automatically make better decisions. Let me just give you a couple examples and we'll be done. Actually, we were going to be done right now, but I have time for a couple examples. Daniel chapter 2. I was just thinking about this morning. Daniel chapter 2. Oops, that's the wrong way. Daniel, in the second chapter of Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and Nebuchadnezzar is amazed at that. Verse 47 of Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar is so amazed, he says this great statement. Listen to this, out of the mouth of King Nebuchadnezzar. Surely your God is the God of gods, and the Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries. No doubt about it, Daniel, your God is the number one God. He's the biggest, strongest, wisest one out of all of them. But then just a few verses later, chapter 3, verse 5, we find Nebuchadnezzar unveiling a 90-foot tall idol. And it says, as soon as you hear the sound of the horn, it comes up with this rule, as soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image. Now that sounds a little strange, given what he just said in chapter 2, verse 47, that God is the number one, Yahweh is the number one God. But you have to understand, for polytheists, that's no big deal to say one God is stronger than all the others. He still worships all the others, but he says, this one's a really good one. And they don't understand the concept of just worshiping only one God, which is what God demanded in the Old Testament and now. And he unveiled this thing, and as a show of loyalty to the king, he worshiped him. And he had religious freedom. He didn't have any religious restrictions. You could worship Yahweh. You could worship any god you wanted. Just you also have to show your allegiance. Well, verse 10, chapter 3, some of the leaders come to Nebuchadnezzar and they say, listen, you issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, the lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of other music must fall down and worship the image of gold. And whoever does not do it will be thrown in the blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of your province in Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, O king. They serve neither your gods nor worship the image of gold that you've set up. Well, Nebuchadnezzar gets furious, and verse 15, he calls them in. He says, when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the pipes, and all kinds of... I think it's hilarious that he's repeating this over and over. You would think all kinds of music would just cover all that, but they have to mention all that. Anyway, you hear all that stuff, then you bow down and worship, then very good. Otherwise, you're going to be thrown in the furnace. He's saying, one more chance, bow or burn. That's your choice. Well, verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied. Now listen to this reply. We don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. We don't have anything to say. We're not going to offer you any explanation. We're not. It's not a situation. It's no real problem for us. We don't have to agonize over any kind of decision-making process here. This decision is as easy as it could possibly be. Verse 17, it says, if we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it. Verse 18, but even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. By the way, that's a great lesson on faith, just as an aside. Faith is not believing that God will do what you demand. Faith is believing that God can do whatever he wants, and a submissive attitude, willing to accept whatever it is God does. Anyway, they said, forget it, we're not going to do it. Their priorities are set up so that the one con, I mean, they look at the pros and cons, and one of the cons is, well, you have to be unfaithful to God in order to worship this thing. Well, that's it. They don't even have to think beyond that. Now, being faithful to God is such a high priority to them, they won't even consider anything else. And they say, well, there's not a single consequence in this world that could possibly rise anywhere near the level of importance as faithfulness to God. So I don't care what you do, King. You can do this, you can do that, you can do anything you dream of, but we're not going to worship that image. No way. You see, they have righteousness as the priority. The other thing I think of is Paul in Acts 2. You know, he's the same way. All the way through, Acts 20. Acts 21. All the way through Acts chapter 20, Paul is heading to Jerusalem. And he's going there, and everybody he knows, all his friends, all the elders, everybody, all the churches, they all keep telling him, don't go to Jerusalem, don't go there, whatever you do, don't stay away from Jerusalem, because if you go there, they're going to get you, your enemies are going to get you. So don't go. And it just won't get, it doesn't faze him a bit. Finally, in chapter 21, a prophet from God comes, a guy named Agabus. And this is God's word. And Agabus comes, and he comes over and he takes Paul's belt, ties his own hands and feet with it. And he says, the Holy Spirit says, in the same way that I'm tied up, the Jews will tie up the owner of this belt and hand him over to the Gentiles. Well, when we heard this, it says, the people there pleaded with Paul not to go to Jerusalem. Don't go, Paul. See, the prophet himself says you're going to be in trouble if you go. And verse 13, Paul answered, why are you weeping and breaking my heart? I'm ready not only to be bound, but to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. Why are you doing this? What you have here is a classic illustration of poor communication. They're not getting through to each other. They're talking right past each other. They can't get through to Paul because he's looking at this situation with a whole different set of priorities. He's looking at the spiritual side of it. He can't even see the physical side of it. Paul's saying, okay, you're saying I shouldn't go to Jerusalem. I realize you're saying I shouldn't go to Jerusalem because if I go there, I'll get beaten, I'll get tied up, I'll get handed over to the Gentiles, probably get killed. But what I'm saying is, why shouldn't I go there? Can you give me just two good reasons why I shouldn't go there? You know, I mean, he's on a whole different thing. He's like, I mean, my whole job is to preach the gospel. If I go to Jerusalem, I can preach the gospel. So tell me again, why shouldn't I go there? And he can't understand what they're saying even. Earthly things, when weighed against the spiritual things, didn't even register because of his priorities. Well, I hope this helps you kind of introduce your thinking to Proverbs. Next time, you know, when Proverbs does warn against sin, the number one sin that Proverbs warns us against, the number one sin that will create a rough path through life is the sin of sexual immorality. By far, that's the biggest warning. Usually warnings in Proverbs come by the verse. One verse, in Proverbs usually one line or one verse. You get the warnings against sexual sin in Proverbs, they come by the chapter. All of chapter 5, half of chapter 6, and all of chapter 7. I mean, it's a lot of material. And so, we're going to talk about that next time. what exactly constitutes sexual sin? I mean, what Proverbs talks about the prostitute. What if it's a woman you're in love with, or what if it's not a woman at all, just a photo or a thought? What if it's not even, you know, Jesus talked about looking with lust. What does that mean? What is lust? Is it wrong to enjoy seeing someone beautiful? The word lust means desire. Is it wrong to have desires? How can you keep yourself from having desires? I thought the Bible said that it's not wrong to be tempted. Jesus was tempted. Well, at what point do you cross the line to adultery or fornication? How far is too far for a single person? How can you protect you, yourself, or how can you protect your spouse against this problem? These are some very important issues, and Proverbs gives us some great wisdom on this, and so we're going to look into that next week.